everybody.
We are the twin sisters, and we are doing our, we usually podcast once a month, so we're doing our monthly podcast, but we're doing it a little bit different this time. We are, in addition to recording it, and it will be on all of the features wherever you can get your podcast, we're also doing Facebook Live. We did Facebook Live with the General Conference recap, where we were with Jeff and Al and Kurt Frankum and Wes Eggert, and that was great, and it was so much fun. And Jeff said to me when he knew we were going to record this week, he said, Tiffany, why don't you guys do Facebook Live? And I was like, I don't know. I agreed to it, and Ariana is a reluctant participant.
I'm being a good sport.
She's being a good sport.
I really just want to chew my Sonic Ice.
Yes.
And scratch my stomach because I'm super pregnant and itchy. But I won't do that. I'll spare you.
You may chew your Sonic Ice, but you know, hopefully they don't have to see you scratching your stomach. So.
It's a little different to be live, but
It is. So now you all know our secrets, which are, we record late at night, and we do this for a couple of reasons. First of all, we have to get our children in bed. Second, we have to get our husbands in bed. And third, we have to kind of get our act together and kind of outline what we're going to do on our podcast. So we're going to see how many This Week in Mormons people are actually late night people who may be joining this podcast live, or if not, the podcast lives on in Facebook infinity. And you could watch us tomorrow morning when, like, perhaps you're fresh as a daisy because you're in bed right now, like you should be.
I bet most people are asleep.
Probably.
but we'll see.
We'll see.
Interesting experiment.
Yes. Yes. All right. So let's start. Oh, here's our outline. So. Okay. All right. So what's been going on in your life?
Well, super pregnant. I have 4 to 6 weeks left, depending on how things go.
Yes.
With this.
And I am so excited to get my hands on that baby.
But our biggest, like, family news since conference is my husband was an Elders Quorum president.
Oh, yes.
Before conference. He is no longer.
We are quite sure that her husband, Keith, prayed that little change to the priesthood.
It could be. He's really been kind of lobbying for a release the past few months. He's been trying to play the baby card.
He was trying to play the baby card.
Baby card wasn't getting him ready.
The state president wasn't buying the baby card.
So anyway, he was super funny. He was texting me from priesthood meeting saying, guess what just happened?
I know. And what we were at my house, we were stuffing Easter eggs. So the men at my house were in our TV room watching priesthood session. We were sitting at the kitchen table, stuffing Easter eggs. And then all of a sudden, like, your phone goes crazy with Keith going, I'm no longer an Elders Quorum president.
And all the guys in your family were like, what?
Yeah, exactly. So I had to go in and go, what's going on?
So yes, he got released. The church was very efficient how they did it. He was kind of wondering, like, okay, how's this transition going to take place? He hopped online Sunday night just because he was curious. Yeah. And as of Sunday night in Salt Lake, they had, like, wiped all of the presidencies out. Like, he no longer had access to any of the information through LDS tools. And
he did not have the all access pass anymore.
No, he was wiped, and his whole presidency was wiped. All the teachers in their callings were wiped. So he's like,
exactly.
Well, I guess I'm released.
Well, you know, it was really interesting because I think at conference they had said to the stake presidents, you know, this place change takes place immediately, you know, get it done. And I thought to myself, I thought, oh, I could see a couple of state presidents going, yeah, we'll get to that.
Right.
Well, Salt Lake just, with the click of a computer button, sped that along and went, yes, you will get to that, because right now you have no one in leadership in the priesthood on the local level.
Yep. So our stake was fast. They called him and his counselors in, I think, Tuesday night after conference, and it was like mass releasing. He said the stake center was just like one after another. They were just shuffling them through, releasing them. And then on Sunday, they all met together and we got a new Elders Quorum president, and I don't know where they're going to put them all because we have a pretty big ward. Uh-huh. So they squeezed them into the young women's room because the young men and young women were combined. But after this Sunday, I don't know what they're going to do with them.
Can they not put them in the gym?
Well, we have three wards in our building, and we're the middle ward. So I think somebody uses the gym that third hour. The Elders Quorum was on the stage, And I don't know where the high priests were. So I don't know if they're all going to squeeze on the stage. I don't think they'll fit on the stage.
That doesn't make any sense. Nobody should be, when you guys are having sacrament meeting, the ward before you, that should be their last hour. That should be their third hour. Because, for example, we go 9 to noon and the next ward starts at 11. So they're in sacrament meeting while we're finishing up our third hour.
Yeah, we're 11. And so then, well, it's our third hour, the ward after us is having what hour?
The ward after you, during your third hour, should be having sacrament meetings starting at 1.
Well, I don't know why.
That does not make any sense. No one should be in that gym.
I don't know
why. No other ward should have claim on that gym.
Uses the gym. Maybe they do use the gym. I'm confused. I'll have to ask.
You'll have to figure that
one
out.
There was some debate over where they would go, but...
Because I'm assuming that's where they're going to have to put our men.
When we do a third hour Sunday, when we do a fifth Sunday lesson, then we're all, usually all in the gym.
Yeah.
So somebody's claiming the gym for the fifth hour.
Or for the third hour.
For the fifth Sunday. I don't know. We'll have to.
Okay. I said that. So he was universally released.
Yep.
You know what? I am not really sure what happened in our ward. I kept meaning to ask Darren, mm-hmm. but we got a new bishop on Sunday. And so, you know, what happened with elders quorum and high priest wasn't as big of a deal as getting a new bishop. And, you know, we knew that our new bishop was coming because, our bishop had been in for 5 years. You know, rumors were circulating. He was a bit trunky. And so what was so funny is my husband, he is the assistant scoutmaster. And the scoutmaster has been in there not very long, just 4 or 5 months, not very long. And, Darren told me, like, even before, he's like, yeah, Brother Johns, that's, you know, he's the scoutmaster. He's like, he's going to be the new bishop. And he totally pegged it. Mm-hmm. That was who our new bishop was. Nice. So he's, you know, he's a great guy. You know, here's one of the things that is so nice. Because he's been in with the scouts and the deacons for probably about 6 months now, he has really bonded with all those 12 and 13-year-old boys. And so by the time he's going to be the bishop to those boys, he is bonded to all the way up until the time they go on their missions.
Oh, that's good.
So I think that'll be really good. And he's a great guy. And
so your ward had other things.
Our ward had other things. And our previous bishop, we loved him too. He was a wonderful man. He did great things for the ward. So, you know, it's sad to see somebody go, but it's also kind of invigorating to see somebody come.
Yeah.
So
lots of changes.
Lots of changes. Okay. So,
oh, you have a review for us.
I have a review.
Because you said you would return and report.
I said I would return and report.
On the garments.
On the garments. Because when we talked about, I think, in our January podcast, maybe our early February podcast, the church was coming out with a kind of a new style of garments for women, and they were going to be a cotton spandex blend. They were going to, I think, be 95% cotton, 5% spandex. They had redesigned the shirts. They had redesigned the bottoms. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of buzz about this, that the church had actually kind of listened to the women on garment design because, I don't know anybody who doesn't have issues. So I have been a dry silk person since day one. You know, I mean, I have tried everything else except the mesh because I knew I'd never love the mesh. But, you know, I've tried the 100% cotton. I tried the Karenessa when it came out and everybody was so hot about the Karenessa. I thought the Karenessa was like wearing Spanx and I thought it was incredibly hot.
It's thick.
I hated it, you know. So what I usually do is I'm like, okay, if there's something new I want to try, I'm going to buy one pair. Right. And then, you know, I'm not doing a major investment. So when they became available, I went out and I bought one pair. It was on a Thursday night. I wore them on Friday. I immediately left work on Friday and went straight back to distribution and bought 7 more pairs. They are amazing.
Love them. She was texting me like the day she wore them.
Yeah.
This is crazy. This is amazing. Once you're not pregnant, you have to try these.
I know.
So tell the people what you loved.
Okay. So here's what I love about it. First of all, I've been telling everybody I know, you got to try the new garments. And, everybody has kind of had, at least that's returned and reported to mm-hmm. me, the same thing. The fabric is so lightweight and so comfortable. It just really doesn't feel like you're wearing garments. And that has kind of been my issue with a lot of garments is I'm like, geez, it's like another layer. It's driving me nuts. It's moving around. It's shifting. And so And the other thing that I like about it is, so it's the 100% cotton, but because it has this amount of Lycra in it, it stretches, but, and so it clings to your body. It's not loose, because that's part of the problem with the dry silk is the dry silk. When I would wear the dry silk bottoms, one of two things would happen. Either, you know, I'd be wearing like granny panties because my crotch was down to my knee because they were falling down, or the legs would roll up, you know, and I'd have the legs all around the crotch. And so these ones stay in place. They cling, but they're not hot. They run very true to size. So I'm a 5'3" is my height. And so I buy the petite, and sometimes I buy the petite and I'm like, these are like way back down past my knee. In whose world of petite is this? And so they run very true to size. Mm-hmm. I also liked the packaging on them, because I don't know if you remember a few years ago, they went to like an AB system and they changed all the sizes.
Confusing. So did they go back to like a kind of a normal sizing system?
Yes. So they come in extra, extra small, extra small, small, medium, large, extra large, and I think like 2X.
Okay. That is language I can understand.
It is language you can understand. And when you look at the package, it tells you it fits the range that it fits the bust size. It tells you the range that it fits the waist size. And, you know, sometimes in the past, those have not run true to size. I buy them and I'm like, hello, drowning. These run super true to size. And so it's really easy to find your size, and they fit according to size. And like you said, you can, and for the waist, they have low waist or natural waist.
So they have different waist options.
Again, you know, because I think with the A and B were like, I never understood the whole A and B thing.
I had struggles.
Again, I understand what a natural waist is, and I understand what a low waist is. Concepts I can get behind. Anyway, they wash really nice. The recommendation is that you wash them in cold, which I normally wash garments in hot, but I was like, okay, I'm going to follow the instructions. So I washed them in cold and then just did kind of a gentle dry. They washed up really nice. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I was wondering about is I thought, okay, how breathable are these going to be in the summertime?
Right.
You know, it's still relatively, it's not hot here yet in Idaho. So I have a friend of mine and their family went to Jamaica over spring break and a couple of other coastal Caribbean countries like that, where it was very hot and very humid. And she said they were amazing. Mm-hmm. Totally breathable. You know, they've got mesh panels down the side, and then they've got some mesh panels in the crotch area. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I am giving the church two thumbs up. They listened to the women. They designed a garment that fits, and I love these garments. I have never said that about any other type of garment. It's always been a struggle for me, but I love these. I really do.
That's awesome.
Well, that's my review.
I've heard from several friends. Like, I've heard nothing but good so far. So I'm excited to try them.
I think they're just going to kind of have to phase everything out. When I went into distribution, I said, how's it been? And they're like, it's been crazy. They've just had, they can't keep them in stock. They've just had a run on them and they're not selling anything else.
Oh, wow.
So anyway.
Oh, we got a question.
I'm
still figuring out how this Facebook Live works.
Oh, okay.
Somebody said, what's it called again? What are they called again?
It's a stretch cotton is what they're called.
They're called stretch cotton.
Just a stretch cotton. They don't have a special name for them like the Karenessa do.
Okay. Stretch cotton.
Just a stretch cotton. All right. And like I said, I understand they're 95% cotton, 5% spandex.
Okay.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay.
Good to know.
All right. Let's move on.
Okay. So what else has been in the news? Oh, we wanted to hit on really quick, the change to the interview policy, because I don't think, well, then conference happened, and there was so much going on at conference.
Exactly, but I don't think we really talked about that in the conference edition.
I don't think we talked about it, but I know there was a march a couple days, day or two before conference, with the group that's trying to get the interview policy changed with the youth. It's not one-on-one, or so the questions that are asked are not so personal regarding chastity in a one-on-one situation with a bishop and a youth.
And I think that those questions probably, some bishops may be a little more probing than others.
I think it totally depends on the bishop. I'm curious to see if they will now come out with more of a very standard,
like the temple questions.
Yeah, like this is what you ask and this is what you don't. They haven't said anything about that, but they did.
They could.
They did just a day or two before this march put out a letter or press release saying basically they're now inviting now bishops are told to let people know that the youth can have somebody else in the interview with them, a parent or
a leader,
youth leader, whoever they're comfortable with.
Yeah. If for whatever reason the youth or their parents don't feel comfortable with that person going one-on-one in with the bishop, if they choose.
I think it's a great, great, great idea.
I think it's a great idea because some youth have no problem with it.
Yeah.
Other youth don't feel so comfortable. So let them have somebody in there and...
Right. Well, and I love the idea of a young woman being able to take a very trusted young woman leader in there with her and feel more comfortable just in general.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it might just help. I could see myself in that situation as a youth being more comfortable having, because I love my young woman leaders.
Exactly.
I would have loved, you know, I just think it could make it more comfortable overall. So I think a good change. I think there are many who would like to see more of a change, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
I think it's a step in the right direction too.
We'll see if anything else follows, but I'm also curious to see how they implement it, like how they let the parents know and let the youth know. Hopefully they do a good job of letting them know that this is an option.
And we'll see. Kudos. So, all right. So we're going to now start talking about stories in the news because we have a lot of them to get to tonight.
There's a lot.
There is a lot. And so we'll see how we go. We try and make this about an hour. And so we'll see where we get in our hour. So the first one we're going to talk about tonight is we're going to talk about an OBGYN from the eastern part of the state over in Idaho. And the reason we're going to discuss this is he is a member of the church. He is a former bishop and stake president, and he's also...
And temple president.
Exactly. He was a temple president for 2 years over in the Philippines. So that's kind of the Mormon connection to this story. So, but before we do that, we have to go back in time about 40 years ago. So 40 years ago, there were these two individuals, Sally Ashby and Howard Fowler. They're no longer married, but at the time they were married to each other. They were having trouble conceiving in 1979. So they went to this gentleman. His name is Gerald Mortimer, who ran an OBGYN practice in Idaho Falls. Found out that Mr. Fowler's sperm count was a little low. And so he said, let's do artificial insemination. We'll use a mix of sperm from Mr. Fowler and an anonymous donor chosen by the couple. So the couple chooses what they believe to be a college student.
They had a list of criteria.
Exactly. They wanted somebody who was tall. They wanted somebody who looked like who was the individual who was going to be the father. Mm-hmm. And so they were inseminated and voila, in 1981, Kelly was born. So they continue to live in the Idaho Falls area. The mom, Sally, continues to be treated by the doctor. He routinely asks about Kelly. And then at some point in time, after a few years, they informed him they were moving to Washington. And the doctor was just kind of devastated by this move to Washington. And so then they moved to Washington. Kelly grows up and she does the infamous Ancestry.com DNA test.
Which is turning out to be like the new Maury Povich of the modern day era. They're putting Maury Povich out of a job. Like, it's crazy. We've done two stories on
people finding their relatives on Ancestry.
We have a friend local just found
a relative
on Ancestry.com just a month ago.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's kind of funny. I'm sure that Ancestry.com never in their wildest dreams kind of intended that this is going to be the consequence of it. Anyway, so the girl takes this test on Ancestry.com and she gets her results back and she has her DNA sample has a match for a parent-child relationship with some individual by the name of Gerald Mortimer. And so she's like, well, that's really odd, because she thinks her father is Howard Fowler.
And they did never tell her.
They never told her.
Oh,
she had no idea. They never told her.
I had forgotten that part of the story.
So she just assumes Ancestry.com is absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. And she mentions to her mother, she said, oh, I'm so disappointed. You know, I paid $70 for this service and I got this really wacky result. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, when she mentions the name Gerald Mortimer to her mother is like, oh.
Then her mom recognizes.
Her mom recognizes it, but she doesn't say anything to the girl first. She calls up her ex-husband and she's like, hey, guess what?
This story is crazy.
It's so crazy.
Crazy.
So
what drives a doctor to do this?
Well, not only to do it, but then why would he go on Ancestry, put his DNA in there, and leave it open for anybody who's...
That's true, because you have to click some type of permission thing, right?
Exactly, to share your DNA for any potential matches. Hello, if you've known that you've done this... because ultimately what he did is he used his own sperm and created Kelly. And so if you've known that you've done this, why would you open yourself up to DNA testing on Ancestry? Anyway, so the parents debate whether or not to tell her. And so they don't tell her. She is over at her father's house helping him clean out old papers and stuff. And she runs across her birth certificate, which, of course, has the name of the doctor who delivered her. Which was Gerald Mortimer. So, obviously, when she sees her birth certificate, she puts two and two together. And they have now filed a lawsuit here in the great state of Idaho. Because she and her parents are suffering a lot of emotional distress as a result of this.
I mean, that's just creepy. You know what this is? This is like a Lifetime movie.
It's so a Lifetime
waiting
movie.
Waiting to be made. In fact, they might have already made it. I'm surprised if they already had one with this storyline.
You know what? They have made it. Because you probably don't remember this. But several years ago, there was an OBGYN in the Virginia area. And his name was Cecil B. Jacobson. He was also LDS.
Oh yeah, he was.
He's totally LDS. And so he's LDS. And he used his sperm and fathered, I don't know, like 75 kids.
Like a bunch. I remember reading about a doctor that had done a bunch. I don't think I knew
he had pictures of them all in the walls in his office.
That's so creepy.
It's really creepy. Anyway, he ended up going to jail over the whole deal. So
does this guy have more? I wonder.
That is a very good question.
They're probably looking into that.
I'm sure they're looking into that. I'm going to kind of assume where there's smoke, there's fire. Mm-hmm. You never know. So he is, so the article has an interview with the Idaho Board of Medicine. He's still technically licensed in Idaho. Mm-hmm. His license is, he's listed as retired. His license is up in June. I don't think it says if the Board of Medicine was, the Board of Medicine, apparently they hadn't heard from any other former patients, according to their executive director. And so I don't know what action, if any, they're taking. Obviously, if he chooses not to renew his license in June, then, that's kind of the end of that. But you kind of got to wonder what are people thinking?
I don't know. It's kind of nuts. I would just really. Yeah. Like to know the motivation there.
Well, and then like church discipline? I don't know. I mean, that's such a gray area. It's not like he had a sexual relationship with the mom.
No. So. He definitely should have his temple recommend pulled, though. That is not very honest.
It's not very honest. I agree there. Anyway. All right. Moving on.
Okay. Moving on. More legal work.
I know. Works. I call this one attorneys behaving badly.
Yeah, this is.
Yeah.
So I know Jeff Nell, last time they recorded before conference, the story had just barely broken about Joseph L. Bishop, the MTC president.
Yes.
Who had been accused of sexually assaulting one of the sister missionaries there back in the 80s. So this story has kind of continued. In and out of the news over the past couple weeks.
Although I have to say, it was really big news before conference. Kind of died down since then.
Conference helped it get pushed back a little.
I have a theory.
We weren't talking conspiracy theory.
We had this theory that Eric Hawkins, who is the church spokesman, that he kind of went to the brethren before conference. He's like, dude, I'm getting a lot of heat about this Joseph Bishop story. Can you dump something big at conference so that, like, you know, that the legs on that story will stop running and it will die a natural death? And that's kind of what happened. Anyway,
yes. Conspiracy theories. We could go all day.
We could. But,
so this latest article, I think, that has come out within the past couple of weeks was about the attorney that the church hired. His name was David Jordan, one of the church one of the attorneys that the church went to
yeah.
investigate the claim.
Well, and what was really interesting is he wasn't from Curt & McConkie. Mm-hmm. Curt & McConkie is the firm that the church usually always turns to do its legal stuff. I think this guy was from Stoll Reeves.
Oh, he's from a different.
He's from a different law firm than the one they normally use. Why that is, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe they wanted someone to do a little dirtier work.
Well, that's apparently what they got.
Because that's what this article is about.
Yeah.
So Salt Lake Tribune ran this article within the past week. They and it had come out over the past couple of weeks that the attorney for the church was creating this dossier on the victim who was assaulted in 1984 and kind of digging up dirt on her. Now, I was horrified. You said this is like a pretty common attorney thing to do. You're used to it.
It, you know, it is. I don't do big litigation like this. Right. But again, you know, when you have an opposing party,
right.
and it is a big case like this one is, where there are lots of money at stake, you know, it's what's going to happen. You're going to hire a private investigator. You're going to do your own digging, and you're going to come up with every piece of dirt on that person.
Mm-hmm.
Is it icky? Is it yucky? Is it beer? You know, yeah. And that part doesn't bother me as much as what the attorneys actually
right.
did with that information. You know, again, that's just kind of standard operating procedure in the law field.
This is why attorneys have a bad reputation.
It is exactly why attorneys have a bad reputation. I'm not going to deny that.
So they took this list of dirt on the victim and they gave it to the attorney for Joseph Bishop, who is also his son.
Exactly.
And they slipped it to him.
Was it Greg? Is that his son's name? I don't remember what the son's name was.
I can't remember what the son's name is.
Yeah, so they slip him the dossier.
So they slip him this information with all the dirt on the victim, which is pretty shady. But also shady on this list of dirt on the victim is the name of a 35-year-old woman who was adopted as an infant by a Mormon couple, and she is the biological daughter of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
The victim had this pregnancy, it says, in her teenage years, so before she went on
the mission. Yeah.
Had this teen pregnancy, had given the baby up for adoption, and then went on to serve a mission.
Yeah.
So they found this...
The biological child.
They found the child. They found her name. They put her on this dossier. She is not too happy, as you can imagine.
Do you blame her? So I'd be mad.
I know. She's living her life in, I don't know, California or wherever. And she was aware. She knew who her biological mom was.
Yeah.
It sounds like that she had done the research several years ago to find her.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting because she said that it took some intense sleuthing on her part to find her birth mom.
Because the adoption was closed.
Because it was a closed adoption in Utah. So I think she's just a little miffed that
in
the church
three
attorney
strokes
did like
of a keypad.
Yeah.
He knows who her birth mom is.
Right, right. And she doesn't want to be dragged into this.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with her. And
exactly.
She, you know, doesn't sound like she has much of a relationship with her birth mom, but or her biological mom. But anyway, it's messy.
It is. That's why I said this is why I call this one attorneys behaving badly. I can understand the dossier if that happens, but it should just be kept internally. It
right.
shouldn't be shared. My issue is when they then share it with his attorney
right.
because they're trying to shame this victim,
right?
Which is totally wrong. That's that's my beef right there is, you know, collect your information for your own personal use,
mm-hmm.
but don't share it.
Right. Well, and just the idea that it could scare off other people from coming forward. I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
The church is a big,
yeah.
big thing,
yeah.
and to come forward would be scary as it is.
Exactly.
To be worry about this happening. So, not the greatest PR move.
No. So, yes. The church has to be thanking General Conference for the story dying down a little bit. And not that that's necessarily a good thing, because this, you know, this is definitely not behavior that should any way or shape or form be condoned. We
right.
don't condone it.
No.
Let's be clear on that.
No.
All right. Let's move on to the next story. We are going to move on to a little bit of political news. And this just was released on Sunday. NPR, there is a show called This American Life, and they release a podcast every Sunday. And their podcast that they released this last Sunday was with Senator Jeff Flake. And as many of you know, he is a senator from Arizona. He is not running for re-election because his chances of getting reelected were not very good, so he decided to kind of step out and just finish his term out. He is very, very active LDS, and one of the reasons his chances for reelection aren't good is he's been very vocal against Trump. Even though he is a Republican and he has not towed the Trump line, mm-hmm. and just doesn't have a lot of good things to say about Trump. And there are apparently a lot of Republicans in Arizona who, you know, disagreed with that. So what was really interesting is NPR had this reporter. Her name is Zoe Chase, and she was essentially embedded with Jeff Flake. And I don't mean that in a really twisted way, like an embedded reporter. She was embedded with Jeff Flake for 4 months. She follows him around the Capitol, basically November, December, January, and February. Mm-hmm. He is trying to pass this DACA legislation, and that is for the Dreamers, to allow children who came to this country with their parents undocumented to be able to stay in the country. And so she is following him around for this 4 month period to see basically the horse trading and the wrangling and everything that goes on in making these deals. And there's several times where he thinks he has a deal and then it falls apart for a number of reasons. And anyway, the bill ends up not getting passed. But it's so interesting because it really is, it's very informative as to how Washington, D.C. really works and how deals are made and how bills are done. Mm-hmm. But it's also informative with regards just to Jeff Flake. She has a whole section in this podcast, well, not a section, but a few minutes where she comments, he has a Book of Mormon on his desk. Mm-hmm. And she says, I've seen him read the book. I've seen him read it online on his phone. I've seen him listen to it. So she asks him about this Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. She also asks him, how is it that you stay so positive? You know, you get all of these roadblocks thrown in your way, and yet you're still so positive. How do you do that? And so he recounts to her the story of Moroni and Pahoran, and how, you know, Pahoran's running the government. Moroni's really mad. He chews him out. Pahoran chooses not to respond, realizing that Moroni just doesn't have all the information. And so Jeff Flake tells her this story and says, you know, that's how I look at people when they are, you know, behaving badly, is I'm just assuming that, you know, perhaps they just don't have all the information. And if they had all the information, this might be different. And so it's a great interview. It's about a great podcast documentary. It's about an hour long. I would encourage all of you to go and listen to it. It's super educational.
Awesome.
Okay.
I have to check it out.
You will.
All right. Okay, next story is, oh, this was fun. This was about the funeral potatoes that they're selling at Walmart.
Yes.
So this story was kind of all over for a couple of days. It was picked up by the Today Show, and I think it was on the New York Post. It went national. So,
and we've talked about funeral potatoes before, right, and the staple that they are.
We love funeral potatoes.
We do love funeral potatoes.
So apparently Walmart has like a food storage dehydrated version,
yes,
of funeral potatoes, and they had them in an algorithm. They were coming up on Facebook.
Yes.
As an advertisement on Facebook. And people were freaking out because they were called funeral potatoes, and nobody outside of Utah and Idaho.
And the South. They said they're big in the
and
South.
And Mormons.
Yes.
Yeah. And knew the term funeral potatoes.
Exactly. And so people are like, why are you calling the potatoes funeral potatoes? That's sad.
What's wrong with those potatoes? So it took some explaining. So the article that I read first about it was from the Today Show, and it was so funny. They were just talking about how, you know, they're not weird, they're not scary, it's actually comfort food.
Yes.
And they were explaining what it was and how it's big, you know, in Mormon society. And
the South, too. They said, apparently they serve funeral potatoes a lot in the South post-funeral.
Right.
But they do attribute the origin of funeral potatoes to the pages of a Mormon Relief Society cookbook from
early 20th century.
So, yes, Mormons can lay claim to the funeral potatoes.
We can stake the claim on that name.
Funeral potatoes are ours. So,
anyway, the guy is linked on the Facebook page to a really funny post about it. It was done by a radio station. And they had put up some pictures of different people's tweets and memes over the confusion of the funeral potatoes. And there were some funny
There were some funny ones.
So you had to get on the... Go to the TWIM Facebook page. Find the link to that, and you'll see all the crazy comments about the funeral potatoes.
Exactly. All right. So our next one is about a program entitled Days for Girls. And many of you, I think many of you probably maybe know about the program. If you don't know about the program, I'm going to explain to you what it is. It was started by this woman by the name of Celeste Mergens. And she is a member of the church, and it began in, I want to say, let's see, when did it begin? I think around 2008 is, or 2007. So Kenya was experiencing a crisis following a political upheaval, and so she was among many of the humanitarians working to solve these development issues. And so she spent a lot of nights kind of worrying, you know, how can I help these people? And she says, you know, she experienced poverty as a child. She knew what it was like to go without food. And so one night before she got into bed, she gets down on her knees and she's praying to Heavenly Father. And she says, what can I do to truly help these people? And so then all of a sudden, boom, 2:30 in the morning, she wakes up and a thought goes through her head. And the thought is, have you asked the girls what they're doing for feminine hygiene? Mm-hmm. And it had never occurred to her to ask that question. So she calls up somebody that she knows that's working with these girls and says, you know, what in these developing countries, what do these girls do when they have their period once a month? Well, she learns that these girls have to stay home from school when they have their period. And they basically, for the whole entire time they have their period, are sitting on a cardboard box. And that, you know, they're getting behind in school as a result of this. And so she realizes, she's like, okay, we need to do something. And so she develops these hygiene kits. And I think she said she's had 28 different varieties of them. Mm-hmm. And I know in my stake that we had a humanitarian activity where we made these hygiene kits. And what it is, you know, you can't really give them feminine products. You need to have something that is self-sustaining in these countries. So they buy them several pairs of underwear, and then they create this liner thing that goes in the underwear that has, it's waterproof.
Right.
And then there's these pads that go in the liner thing. And so the theory is that you can then, you know, when these pads are soaked, that these pads can then be washed and dried out and reused so that these girls, when they are having their period, can go to school. And so it has just taken off. We've got a cousin's wife who this is her passion. Mm-hmm. She makes these. She had a toe. She's really into exercise, and she had a toe and she broke her toe. So what did she do while she was convalescing? She sat at her serger and her sewing machine and made hundreds of these. And so they go in these kits. And, Celeste says that, she said, Mergens doesn't believe she is alone in her ability to break down such barriers. Speaking of members of the church, Mergens says, when you tell them our goal is that every girl everywhere, period, is to have one of these kits, they say, okay. Other people go, that's not possible. Don't be ridiculous. Set an achievable goal. Mm-hmm. But you never hear that from Relief Society. And the reason she was in the news is she was recently honored with 20 other women for their achievements and example of leadership worldwide at an event called Hear Her Song. And she was not only honored, but also there were Justice Sonia Sotomayor, former First Lady Michelle Obama, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. So she was honored with, you know, really these big weights. And she talks about in the article just, you know, she's like, I was just doing my thing.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out how to solve a humanitarian crisis. I didn't do this for any honor or anything like that. I just want to help these girls.
And what a unique angle to take. Like, I mean, clearly the spirit was whispering to her, but... I'm the, like, who would have thought?
Yeah.
Nobody in the Western world thinks no. about that.
No, like, because we just go to the store and purchase what we need and dispose of it when we're done.
So amazing that she thought of it. Yeah. And it's taken off. I feel like it's been all over. I wonder how many they've sent total.
Does
it say in the article?
It does not say in the article. So I'm going to throw this out to anybody out there in TWIM Nation who might be affiliated with Days for Girls. Oh, look, we just had a comment here in Vancouver, Canada. They had a Relief Society activity to help Days for Girls.
Yeah, I think it's pretty popular. Yeah.
Anyway, so if anybody knows any statistics of how many of these humanitarian, these kits have gone out, we'd love to hear that. Post it on our Facebook page.
It's got to be hundreds of thousands.
Oh, yeah. I would think so.
Maybe millions. Who knows? I don't know. It's amazing project. Great effort. And I'm glad to hear that she's being recognized. That's awesome.
I know. It's awesome, too. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Next article we have. This was an op-ed article from Deseret News by Melvin Beshore. And he wanted to know where the Mormon youth trek phenomenon came from. So he did some research. And I thought this would be appropriate to talk about since we've been talking about trek.
Exactly.
You've been prepping for trek.
Speaking of trek, folks, 72 days.
That's all?
I know. I went to a trek training on Sunday night. And on Sunday night, they told us 74 days until we leave for trek. And I sat there and went, I am nowhere near ready.
So you're stressing.
Oh, I'm totally stressing. So this is my workout shirt. I went and walked both last night and tonight because I really have to get my butt in gear and get in shape I'm not so worried about the hike part. I'm like, okay, I think I can do the hike part. The women's pull is scaring me to death. So yes, 72 days from today, I will be on the mountain trekking. So please, Ariane, share with me the origins of this experience.
We can't wait to hear your report when you're done.
I will take copious notes. We may have to have a whole episode dedicated to my trek experience.
It'll be like a therapy session.
Exactly.
For you.
Except, you know, one of the things that they told us on Sunday night is they said, when you are up there as a mom and pa, you cannot say anything negative. You have to be totally positive because if you're negative, the kids will pick that up on that. And I know that.
That makes sense.
And I would not go up there negative. I'm sharing my concerns privately, but rest assured, when I step on that mountain, Pollyanna Tiffany will be there and be cheering everybody on and go, you can do this.
And then you'll come back and give us all the gory details.
Oh, yeah.
So this op-ed piece, he was looking back, trying to figure out, like, how did these treks become popular? He traces it back to when they really started to get popular around the year 1997.
Mm.
And I had forgotten this. This is the year I graduated from high school, mm-hmm. so I was not involved. But that was the sesquicentennial celebration.
This was a big deal for President Hinckley.
Which I do remember that whole year, a lot of focus on Pioneer.
Yeah.
So back in 1997, I guess, is when it just blew up.
Yeah.
Like people started trekking everywhere. He said that in his findings, it is not only happening in the Western United States. He said that it is not uncommon in South America and other places around the globe that people are doing treks.
It's crazy.
I know.
I
have no idea.
Okay, so I really want to know. So a trek in South America, I mean, are you doing the hand carts? Are you doing the Pioneer thing? Are you making it more cultural to your culture down there?
I don't know. So it must just be happening all over more than we think.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think every ward is doing it, but he's saying it's not uncommon to see them done in South America.
Well, and the other thing he talks about in that article, too, is he kind of goes through the history, and he talks about, you know, there were treks before 1997.
Right.
You know, he talks about some scouts that did it up in Ensign Peak.
I think the first documented that they know of is about 1976, or 1966.
Yes.
Before 1966, some Boy Scouts had done it.
Yes.
Up in the canyon, just local.
Emigration Canyon in Utah.
Yes. Yeah. But in the year 1966, the first group that they know of came up from Phoenix to Utah. They built some homemade carts in Phoenix, brought them to Utah, went up the canyon and did it. And I think it was a scout group from Phoenix. Then a couple years later in 1968, it says 44 girls from East Long Beach State in California came to Utah with homemade hand carts.
Yes.
And it says that they did not know that the Scouts had done it a couple years before. They just thought this was their own unique idea. And so they did it down Immigration Canyon.
They had to qualify. Did you see in that article what they had to do?
Oh, yeah. They, like, had to train. They had to, if you wanted to go on this trip, you had to, like, be able to run a certain mile in a certain amount of time.
Yeah. You know, you weren't in shape. You weren't going.
They had to sew their own, you know, clothing. But this was the best. Somebody who was on that trip with the girls in 1968 said that they were in the canyon trekking and a group of guys, college guys, went by in a convertible and they yelled, "Hey, you're too late. They've already settled the valley." Not funny.
That's pretty funny.
I mean, in 1968, they're probably like, "What are these crazy girls doing?" Now you would just be like, "Oh, it's trekkers.
It's trekkers. Well, you know, I have to tell you. So last we have a place that our stake uses that's up about 45 minutes from here for trek, and a number of other stakes and wards use it for trek too. But this location isn't only a trek location because the guy who owns it also, like, you can go up there and do horseback riding. They've got a great facility for weddings, so they usually have two or three events going on. So we were up there for a stake leadership academy for the youth. My husband was still the young men's president at the time. Anyway, this couple had come up to go horseback riding for the afternoon. So they had driven up and they had seen all these people in pioneer clothing, and they came up and they're like, "What's with all the people down there in pioneer clothing?"
They're a little confused.
So I kind of had to explain to them, well, they're doing a reenactment.
Don't worry, this is not one of those polygamous colonies. Well, that's funny.
It was. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. So then this says that, like, in the 70s, BYU and Ricks College, through their college courses, kind of developed a trek course.
Yes. And that they used for, like, leadership activities.
Right. And that eventually wards and youth caught on and started asking to come and do those programs during the summer for their youth conference. And then 1997 hit and it went hog wild, and stakes started putting on their own treks wherever they were, not necessarily traveling to Utah. But one thing that I thought was super interesting in this article was he talked a little bit about Brigham Young and kind of the atmosphere.
Oh, yes.
Did you read this part?
I read that part.
In the 1850s, he talked about how Brigham Young really got a lot of flack for the handcart program. That some people were blaming him for it not being successful.
Well, I think they only used it for 1 year. You know, they're trying to economize.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out, you know, how can we get these saints over there in the most economical way possible? So they come up with this handcart idea, which turned out not to be so successful.
Right. And then that's when he got up and gave the speech in the tabernacle to go help people. He was fired up. He was feeling the pressure from people who were upset and being responsible for all these people. And
I never realized how much flack that he had over that handcart program.
And the stories we tell, it's all just like glory and glossed over, and everybody was willing to help. But this says that in his research, he found that people were reluctant to talk about handcarts while he was alive.
Exactly. And any negative aspect of handcarts.
Like, it wasn't really until after Brigham Young passed away that people really started telling some of the real stories about what happened, and talking about it more and writing it down and it being publicized.
Interesting.
And really them looking at it at that point in time as a miracle versus just a horrible event.
Well, and I also think, doesn't it talk about somewhere there in the article, because, you know, so often we associate the traveling across the plains with these handcart stories, which are such a small part of the traveling across the plains. And so, you know, that was kind of another issue too, is that, you know, the pioneers who didn't do the handcarts and had the wagons, they had a much easier time and they had a lot of joy on their journey. Mm-hmm. And the focus has always been, the people who died.
Right. So. Right. And I think that's come over the years as these stories have been passed down you know.
Yeah. So, you know, and speaking of which, this just kind of struck me, you know, as I go on trek, and, you know, we're going to have these kids that, you know, we're going to be mom paws to, and, you know, want them to have, you know, some sort of a spiritual experience while this is going on. But it just struck me. I'm like, you know what? I need to not focus just on how hard this experience is, or how hard this experience is going to be for the kids, or how hard this experience was for their ancestors, mm-hmm. but also the fact that a lot of people traveling across the plains had a lot of joy mm-hmm. and had a great experience, and to maybe like bring that in so that the kids realize this isn't all just a really sad, hard time. Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea.
So, I may have to go digging in some ancestor stories, because we definitely had ancestors on both our mom's side and our dad's side in Willie Martin. But we also had other ancestors who weren't in Willie Martin who crossed the plains.
Right, in regular wagon
companies. In regular wagon mm-hmm. companies. So maybe I need to go dig around in their stories and see what they have to say. Share those on Trek.
Yeah, you should share those on Trek.
Okay.
Poor wagon pioneers are being left out.
Exactly, exactly. So... Okay, let's finish with our last story on okay. the mockumentary, and then we will get to our favorite things. So, this, many of you have heard of what a mockumentary is. You know, think, The Office or Parks and Recreation, where it's kind of like they're filming something, but they're really not like reality TV. Uh-huh. So there is this gentleman, and he is from Rexburg, Idaho. His name is Mark Mattia, and he is creating this show called The Singles, and it's based on a Mormon singles ward. He says this project will be different from other people's mockumentaries like The Office and Parks and Recreation, because the film crew will actually be part of the show. So we're going to kind of, I think, have a show within a show okay. sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And he says LDS comedy has kind of dropped, and we want to bring it back up with this show. It's a mockumentary about a singles ward. So apparently he has cast 6 people to be various characters in this singles ward. And what's really interesting, to add a unique angle, is the film crew people that he's going to use, none of them are going to be members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So they're going to be here filming about this singles ward okay. and all of the cultural idiosyncrasies of a singles ward.
So the film crew that is filming... The film crew that is pretending to film?
The film crew that is pretending to film. Yes.
They're going to be an actual film crew.
I think they're going to be an actual...
Not actors.
Yes, they're going to be an actual film crew.
And then there will be a film crew filming the film crew.
Yes. Okay. I think that's how it's going to work. Anyway, it is very confusing. So they are filming this in Rexburg. So, you know, uh-huh. if you are in Rexburg, you know, perhaps you can get in on being an extra or something. What he is hoping is he's been in contact with multiple video streaming sites like VidAngel, and hopes that the show will be picked up when it's ready to air. So we'll have to follow that, because that could be...
That has potential.
It has potential. More so probably just to watch the non-member film crew going,
what did I sign up for?
These people are wacky.
I'm so confused.
I'm so confused.
Yeah, I would watch that.
Okay. All right. Well, shall we move on to our favorite things?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do our favorite things. Again, not sponsored. These are just things.
Things we like.
So you want me to go first?
Yes. Why don't you go first?
My favorite thing that I'm going to share this week, I can't believe I haven't shared this yet, is my favorite podcast to listen to.
Oh.
Other than This Week in Mormons.
Oh, of course.
It is
Nothing was better than the twins.
It is called The Popcast.
Oh, yes, I love The Popcast.
Knox and Jamie. And I just love it. If you like pop culture, this is like the podcast for you. They talk a lot about pop culture things.
They do.
But what else? The other thing I love about them is they are from the Deep South, so they have cool accents.
Yes, listen alone for the accents.
And the other thing I love is they are super religious.
They are.
They are, I don't know what denomination, but... Southern evangelical type.
Some sort of a Christian denomination.
Right.
They talk about going to church every week.
They do. And I get super excited every time they talk about their religion and their church uh-huh. experiences, because there are so many similarities to being Mormon. Like, they'll say things, like they did a Halloween episode once, and they were talking about how you can't call the church Halloween party a Halloween party. It has to be a harvest yeah. festival or a hallelujah party. And I was like... They go through all the same struggles we go through. Not all the same, but a similar. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, so there's a lot of overlap.
I get excited every time they talk about their churchy stuff. But it's just a silly podcast. They talk a lot about pop culture and TV and movies. But then they also do – my favorite ones that they do are their holiday episodes.
Oh, yeah.
They always do like a holiday episode. And so it's fun. It's fluffy and funny to listen
to.
So I highly recommend it.
It is, you know what, it is something you would want to, like, listen to while you're cleaning your house.
Yeah.
You know, because it doesn't take a lot of brain power to follow it. Some podcasts, you're like, I can't listen to this while I'm doing anything else. I have to pay attention.
So. Yeah, you don't have to concentrate. So, okay. And half the time, I don't know what they're talking about because...
I know. That's one of the things when I listen to it.
They're deep, deep into pop culture. They know, like, every actor out there. So sometimes I don't, but a lot of time I do.
Exactly. Same thing with me. Sometimes I'm like... Wow, I'm really out of the loop. I must be old.
I must be old.
Exactly.
Who's the actor they're talking about?
Okay. So
what's yours?
My favorite thing this week. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a big plug for Family Search. Oh. I have been on a little rampage lately. And let me tell you what started this rampage. So, as we've discussed in the past, our mother has passed away, and so has our father. And so my mother, for a period of about 10 years, kept a journal. And after she passed away, my dad transcribed the journal because nobody could read my mother's handwriting. I'm not even sure my mother could read her handwriting. So he transcribed it in his own handwriting, and then my grandparents typed it up. And in addition to my grandparents typing it up, they wrote a life history about my mother, took a lot of excerpts out of their journal. My grandparents were meticulous journal keepers. And they put together this big three-ring binder that has my mom's journal, their thoughts, pictures, things that my aunts had written about my mom. I think for my grandparents, putting this together, and they did it for us kids, was probably a very kind of therapeutic thing as they were working through their grief with my mom dying. So somehow or other, and I can't even remember how this all came up, one of my mom's roommates from college that she was really close to, our family was really close to, we called them aunts and uncles, we spent a lot of time together growing up, found out that my mom had this journal, and she's like, oh, I would really love to read this journal and this life history on your mom. And so I said, oh, I've got an extra copy, I'll send it to you. Well, I got busy and I never got that done, and then she kind of bugged me, and I was like, yeah, I'll get to it. So the other night I go to pull it out, and I, you know, I have a copy of the journal, but I don't have an extra copy of like her life history, the things that her sisters wrote about her, that sort of a thing. So I pulled them all out of this three-ring binder and I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to scan this. And rather than mail it to Marcia in the mail, I'm just going to upload it to Google Docs and I'll deliver it to her that way. And so then I thought about it. I thought, well, if I'm going to scan this, I might as well put it on Family Search. So if you don't know, there is a function out there on Family Search, and it's called Memories. And in this memory section, you can upload photographs, you can upload documents, you can upload audio recordings. And so you can put all of these family documents and you upload it according to the person. So obviously I went to my mother, pulled up her name, went to her memory section, and uploaded these things that were specific to her in her memory section. And I'm like, my gosh, this is going to be here 50 years from now when I'm not, for my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. So then it got me into, well, I need to scan pictures. What else can I add? So I've been like a crazy person going through memorabilia, scanning stuff, putting it up on there, and it's just been so much fun for a couple of different reasons. It's been fun to take a trip down memory lane. It's also been fun to know, you know what? I am doing something that my grandchildren are going to benefit from. It's also been fun because family history and genealogy was huge to my mother's parents. And so I can't help but thinking, I'm getting some good karma for my grandparents for doing this. They're go, Tiffany. So it's just been really fun. So and this is my new Sunday afternoon activity. So rather than taking a nap when I come home from church, I am scanning these documents. I am uploading them to the memory section on Family Search. And it's just a great thing. So I'm just going to encourage all of you to take advantage of that. Save those memories, save those documents in a place like that where they're gonna be there for generations.
I know. I'm excited to look at them because I don't have them. You're the oldest, so you inherited all that stuff.
Exactly.
So now I can get online and see.
I know. And because I'm the oldest and you don't have them, I feel all the guilt if I don't do something. You get off guilt-free.
That's right.
So.
Well, very cool.
Okay.
Okay.
I think that about wraps it up for us. Everybody out there in Facebook who joined us, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
There's a few other night owls.
And maybe some of you will see this tomorrow, but we appreciate you joining us. And I don't know. I kind of liked it. I'd do it again.
You'd do it again?
I'd do it again. Am I going to talk you into doing it again?
We'll see.
Okay. All right. So, Twim Nation, good night for now.
Bye.
And, look, I got orange on my hand. I think that was from your child's marker.
Probably.
All right. Good night, Twim Nation. Take care.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
This Week in Mormons. This Week in Mormons. This Week in Mormons. This Week in Mormons. The original Mormon news.